This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
I have a new song that's almost ready for prime time, and it's called Did Trouble Me. And I find as I get older, it just takes such a long time to stick those words in your head, you know, so you don't have to read or, you know, memorization. It just takes longer and longer. But once they're in there, then you got to figure out how to get them out. And then finally it all sort of comes together. So I'm going to say the word Lord in this song. And as I say the word Lord, you get to choose. It could be Christ the Lord. It could be Lord Buddha. It could be Lord Krishna. It could be Lord of the Rings. Whatever you want to do. And it sort of goes like this. If I turned my head so I could not see, my Lord did trouble me. If I let things stand that should not be, my Lord did trouble me. If I held my head too high, too proud, my Lord did trouble me. If I raised my voice too little, too loud, my Lord did trouble me. Did trouble me. With the ringing of a bell in the back of my mind, did trouble me, did stir my soul, oh, to make me human, to make me whole. If I slept too long and I slept too deep, put a worse vision into my sleep. If I held myself away and apart, and the tears of my brother did move my heart, did trouble me, did stir my soul, for to make me human, to make me whole. This I know, this I'm sure. Mistakes. I feel good about that. So I emailed this to Holly a couple days ago, and this just blew my mind. In one of the talks I give, I talk about 7 billion people. That's how many we have walking the earth today. And every hour it increases. And you just go, wow, that's a lot of people. But the question that came to my mind that nobody had an answer for other than Google search was, 7 billion people, how many animals do we kill to feed the 7 billion people. Now, I'm not a vegetarian and not vegan, but maybe once a week I'll go vegetarian, and it's nice, it's different. And then, you know, I'll visit In-N-Out Burger once in a while. But it's like, I never thought about that. And then I remember what the Buddha said about the world. He said, the planet Earth, I call samsara. This is where birth and death occur. And when I first heard that statement, I thought it was a little overly dramatic, birth and death. But that seems to be about the only thing that ever happens on Earth. You know, everything is created. We have a marathon today. We have Carmageddon. We have all that's been created. It will exist for a while, and then it will be destroyed. And then something else will take its place. So, 7 billion people. Here we go. Worldwide, an estimated 140 billion animals are killed for food every year. 140 billion animals. Now, we're talking about shrimp. You know, if I eat shrimp, I eat like 10, you know. Whereas maybe a beef cow could feed 100 people, you know. It said that this includes marine animals, about 50 billion. So about 383 million animals every day are being killed. I know. Isn't that a lot? Bummer. And so when the Buddha said this world is filled with birth and death, he wasn't kidding. He was like right on. So what can we do as humans? Well, we could become vegetarians or vegans, but I got a feeling most of us aren't going to go there, except maybe occasionally. But maybe what we could do is honor all those creatures that have died so we can practice the Dharma, you know? And maybe we could do like one good thing a day. Just one good thing a day. And in doing that one good thing, we could share the merit with all those creatures that have died so they can have a better rebirth next time and maybe be closer to the top of the food chain. And maybe one day they can be human. And then maybe one day they can have a choice in what they eat. Or maybe not. And we think about ourselves as being human at the top of the food chain, you know, and who's going to eat us? Well, the lions and tigers and bears would give it a try if they could. So we have to be careful about that. So we're just here such a short time. Something to think about. Now, next month, I'm going to a conference. I'll be going to the Sagely City of 10,000 Buddhas, and we're going to have 7 Catholic monks, and we're going to have 7 Buddhist monks, and we're going to get together for a couple days, and we're going to talk about formation. How do you form a monk in the modern world? What do they need to do, and how do they need to do it? So I'm putting together the website for the monks. I'd share it with you, but I can't. And what we have is we have certain questions that we're going to throw out to the 7 monks from each tradition and get the Catholic perspective and get the Buddhist perspective and see how similar they are and see how different they are. So the first question that will be asked by the Buddhists to the Buddhist is, what is a Buddhist layperson? What is a Buddhist layperson? And what I find as I give talks and talks and talks is that most of the Buddhists I know aren't really religious Buddhists, but they're like Buddhist meditators or Buddhist lifestyle people, you know, or they read like a lot of Buddhism, but they're not really like religious Buddhists. So in order to become a Buddhist layperson, what's the first thing you need to be? You need to be human. I know it sounds really stupid, but that's the first thing, first requirement. The second requirement to be a Buddhist layperson is you need to take the 3 refuges and the 5 precepts. The 3 refuges are, I take refuge in the Buddha as a world teacher. I take refuge in the Dharma as the medicine that will ultimately relieve my suffering and end it. So the Dharma is not looked at as just simply a good teaching. It's looked at as a way to end human suffering. It's a prescription, if you will. The third refuge is taking refuge in the monks and nuns, the Buddhist monks and nuns, who, in their own special way, are trying to live the Dharma. And we have a variety of monks and nuns and a variety of lifestyles as well. So we want to sort of keep them around. So Buddhist monks and nuns will remind us every time we see the robes that there was a guy named Siddhartha who became a Buddha, and he had followers, and his original followers were his Sangha, the monks, and eventually the nuns as well. And they chose to live in the world in a very special way. They chose to live in the world but not be part of it, in the sense that most lay people are. So in order to be a Buddhist lay person, there's a ceremony, and you take the three refuges and you take the five precepts. Five precepts are not to take life, not to take what is not given, not to indulge in sexual misconduct, not to speak unskillfully, not to lie, and not to consume intoxicants. Five precepts, three refuges. That's what a Buddhist lay person is. But there's another level of being a Buddhist lay person, and this is the level of being an Atthasila, an eight precept holder, holding the eight precepts. And oftentimes in Buddhist countries, on the full moon and new moon days, Buddhist lay people will go to the temple and they'll accept the additional three precepts to hold while they're at the temple. And then when they leave the temple, they give the additional three precepts back and hold the five. Okay, so what are those additional three precepts? What are they in for at the temple on the full moon day? Well, number one, the third precept, not to have sexual misconduct, changes into not to have sexual activity at all. So while you're at the Buddhist temple, participating in full moon day ceremonies or the Buddha's birthday or katina when the monks come out of their retreat times, you don't have sex at the temple. And I guess that makes sense. Number seven is you would undertake the precept to refrain from eating at forbidden times. Now, if you're a monk or a nun, there are certain times when you're allowed to eat and certain times when you're not allowed to eat. So if you're following the Theravada tradition, the early Buddhist tradition from India, you would eat after sunrise and then you would eat before noon. So those are your two opportunities to eat. So a forbidden time would be after 12 o'clock. So when you go to the temple and take the extra three precepts, then you wouldn't eat after 12 o'clock. And that makes it really convenient because then you can have the other lay people cooking the food and they only have to cook a little light breakfast and then a big lunch and then they can go and do their other stuff because food has been done with. Look at it as fasting every day of your life. If you only eat in the morning or before 12, then the rest of your day is a fast. Now, the next precept is something you might find a bit odd, and it's combined, but it goes like this. I will take the precept to refrain from dancing, singing, listening to music, going to see entertainments, wearing garlands, using perfumes, and beautifying the body with cosmetics. So when you go to the temple, the idea is you want to sort of get rid of some of those desires. And what happens with music and entertainment, it creates desire to see more entertainment and listen to more music. And that's why iTunes is so huge. It's created desire. So you sort of say, well, okay, I'm not gonna listen to any music or watch TV. I'm just gonna be at the temple. And I'll be a little bit hungry, and I won't look as good as I normally do because I'm going to leave my fragrance and cosmetics at home. And this is an odd thing, you know. You know, when I was younger, like a teenager, I would spend like an hour to really look good before I went on a date, and I had like Brill cream in my hair, and if anybody remembers a ducktail, and that little pompadour wave thing. You know, it took a long time to get that to work. And then I would have like Jade East. I don't know if anybody remembers that as a cologne, but that was, you know, a really popular one when I was young. And I was looking good. Now I spend an hour not to be repulsive. I've gotten to that age now where I've given up trying to look good. So we simply need to be clean. And then, you know what? They even have deodorants now that don't have fragrance. So you could go to the Buddhist temple and be like normal. And then people would like accept you for just being who you are for that one day. You wouldn't have to pretend to be anybody else. Of course, for Buddhists, we're still always struggling to try to figure out who we really are anyway. And then the last little thing they sort of throw in is you can't sleep in comfortable beds or sit in high throne-like chairs. So you're sitting on the floor a lot. And if you want to take a nap in the afternoon at the temple, you sleep on the ground, or if there's a nice hard futon, you sleep on that. I had a chance to stay in my teacher's temple in Sri Lanka. This was an ancient cave temple, which was really cool except for the spiders. And his mattress was made out of coconut hair. So the hair on the outside of the coconut, they sort of scraped off and put it in a mattress. It was the most uncomfortable thing that you've ever laid on. But he was following the precepts, and it worked fine. So the eight precepts are designed to make us a little more free. I know that really sounds weird, because you think that we're more free if we have permission to do more things rather than less things. But in Buddhism, what we want to be free from is desire and craving. So this is a way to go in that direction. So the next question that will be asked is, how do you form as a monastic? In your tradition, either Catholic or Buddhist, how do you form as a monastic? What's the deal? Well, the first thing, you have to be a Buddhist for a year. Then you have to take the eight precepts and hold those for a year. Not just for one day at the temple and a full moon and new moon. But you hold all eight precepts for a year. At the end of that year, then you're given an extra two precepts. And I've got those too. So you end up with 10 precepts. Okay, what they add in there is they add the precept of not accepting gold or silver. You can't have wealth. You can't hold on to wealth. You can't carry wealth. Thankfully, our American currency is no longer supported by silver or gold. It's just simply paper. So it sort of works out okay for us monks. It has no value. But what would the monks do? If the monks needed to go someplace and the monks needed to have some kind of currency, what would they do? They would have a layperson with them who would carry their money. And if they wanted something, the layperson would buy it for them. And then when it was time to eat, the layperson would offer them the food. So the monks had this sort of symbiotic relationship with the lay people. They were like connected all the time. And each one, the monks were connected to the lay people for their survival, and the lay people were connected to the monks for their spiritual evolution and eventually liberation. So the monk would hold the 10 precepts, and then at the end of 2 years would take the 227 precepts and be a fully ordained monk. And then at the end of 5 years, if they held all the precepts and the teacher felt that they were sufficient in their skill as a monk, then they would be given permission to leave the temple or monastery. This is the Theravada, ancient Buddhist tradition, and seek out other teachers, or start their own temple, or simply be a wandering monk all alone without a teacher at all. They would let the Dharma be their teacher, the teachings of the Buddha. So that's how a monk would be formed. And then, of course, every year as a monk, they would go into rains retreat, which is 3 months, usually monsoon season, if we were lucky enough to have monsoons. And then they would come out, and so a monk's years would be measured by how many rains retreats they did. So in putting together the little website for the monks, I had to know when all the monks were ordained, Catholic and Buddhist. And so we put the ones with the most years at the very top and the ones with the least years at the bottom. The new monks, the monks that were ordained in 2010 or 2011. We have one monk that was ordained in 1959. He's still a monk. Wow. The stories he can't tell. Yeah. Because it's about what monks don't do rather than what they do do. So after that long a time not doing stuff, wow. How does it feel to have a simple life? How does it feel to look at the world as a monastic? You know, is it good? Well, for some it is, and they find a home. For others, it's just, it's not enough, and they need to go back to lay life because they like the flash and the trash. And they also like relationships. You know, the monks and the nuns have a really interesting relationship. It's a relationship of community. So it's a relationship of praying together and staying together. But that may not be enough for some. You know, some may want to, you know, have children or have an intimate relationship and have that personal time with a special human. And in the monastic community, that special time is devoted to the Buddha or Christ, I suppose. You know, it's creating and forming a relationship with a higher being, a higher power. Or in the Buddhist sense, it would be forming a relationship with your practice and that raft that you've taken to cross over to the other shore. The other shore where there's no suffering and there's no creation and there's no destruction. The next thing we're going to talk about is why are people leaving the monastic tradition? Every year it's harder to get new recruits, and some of the old monks and nuns seem to want to get out into the world and get a job and have a mortgage and maybe buy a car. And I think perhaps what's happening in the modern world is monasticism isn't satisfying in the way it used to be. We have so many distractions now. We have cell phones and tablets and websites and wow, you know, and that's just the technological stuff. And then it always gets more complicated. I don't know if you've realized that in your life, but life never gets simpler. It always gets more complicated. And maybe they feel sort of left out and they want to get back into the flow again. They want to see what they've been missing for 5 years or 10 years or 20 years. And unfortunately, sometimes when they get out there and they see what they've been missing, they haven't missed much at all, you know? It's just so superficial and so unsatisfying and not fulfilling, you know? And then they want to go back. And yet, you know, it's hard to go back. It's hard to go back as a layperson. It's hard to go back as a monastic. Because now you're sort of in this limbo. You're sort of in between. You have one foot in the monastic tradition, and you have one foot in life. And you're sort of doing this dance and trying to find stability and balance. And so sometimes the old monks will end up at the monasteries working in the kitchen, sweeping the floors, just to get the feeling of what it was like to be a monk again. You know? I call them Dharma bums. They never quite make the break in Buddhism. They're always sort of half and half. Another topic is senior monastic burnout. Do monks burn out? They do. You know, monks never get a vacation. It's like being retired. The worst thing about retirement is you never get a vacation. You got to work to get a vacation. And the monks don't work. The monks have a lifestyle. It's just what they do. So where do you go and not do that when you're a monk? Even when you dress down in your civilian clothes and pretend to be a layperson, you know, you can spot them. They're too nice sometimes. They say please and thank you, you know. they don't mind giving you a break in the line. You can go in front of them. You know, and so they're sort of like always like this monk, and they never just get away from it. And then what they've started to see is they started to see how difficult life is for all the people. And oftentimes in their religious counseling, they deal with just some horrendous problems of what it means to be a human being. And they don't have answers. The answers are not available just because you're monastic. And so there is this burnout thing. And how do you prevent them from getting burned out? How do you make it sustainable, that practice and that goal, and not get distracted by all the stuff that keeps going on? Then there are monastics that go out on their own, like in the ancient days. So if a monastic goes out on his own, how does he keep his vows while having a small apartment in West LA? When nobody would know if you broke them except for you. How do you keep your vows? And then how do you support yourself? If you're a monk, your center or your monastery or your temple has supported you. Do you get a job? What kind of jobs are you qualified for? Maybe a greeter at Walmart? You know? I don't know. And then are you going to have health insurance? You can have any kind of retirement benefits if you've never worked because you've been a monk your whole life and you missed out on Social Security and Medicare. Yeah. And so these are really interesting, I don't want to say problems, but sort of bumps in the road of monasticism. How do you do these things? And do Buddhists do it differently than Catholics do? I think they do. Neither one is better or worse, but it's just simply different. Because our final goal in Buddhism is much different than the final goal in Catholicism. And in the monastic tradition of Catholicism, you need a leader, number one. You need an abbot. You need somebody who's going to run the place. And then you need a rule. And if you know anything about the Benedictine monks, they have the rule of Saint Benedict. And so you live by that, you know? In Buddhism, we have our precepts, and we live by the precepts. And we have the Dharma, which is what we practice. And we have the Buddha as an example. But we have a lot more flexibility, I think, you know, than some Christians might have or Catholics might have. So it's an interesting dilemma that we face as a Buddhist. So first there's the layperson, then there's the serious layperson with the 8 precepts, then there's the novice monk with the 10 precepts, and then there's the fully ordained with the 227 precepts. And then there's the lifestyle and the practice and not getting distracted. And ultimately, given enough lifetimes, achieving your full perfection as a human being. How cool is that? Nirvana. And we don't know how many lifetimes we've already been practicing. So it could happen at any time. Could happen today, on the way back to wherever you're going to go. You could get your nirvana. Cool. So how do we get our nirvana? How do we go there? And I wanted just to briefly touch on sila, samadhi, and panya. And you've probably heard those words before. And if you haven't heard those words before, sila is personal discipline, samadhi is concentration meditation, and panya is wisdom or mindfulness meditation, which I think is an interesting way of looking at it. So sila would be the foundation of our practice, and that would be the 5 precepts we take, the 5 precepts of not to take life, not to take what is not given, no sexual misconduct, not to lie, not to consume intoxicants. And then we would go into our samatha meditation, samadhi meditation, tranquility meditation. We have 40 different kinds of tranquility meditation we want to do. Some of them don't sound like they're going to make you very tranquil. I've got the list here. But why would we want to do tranquility meditation? It seems to me we almost need to do tranquility meditation because we need to take our bliss and pleasure and happiness with us. If we rely on the world around us for our bliss and happiness and pleasure, we're going to be so disappointed. Because it's so temporary. I mean, even if you go to Disneyland all day, you still have to leave. And there goes your bliss and pleasure and happiness. But if you find it inside rather than outside, every place you go, you got it. And why would that be important? Because every year, 140 billion animals are being slaughtered. Can you go into the world and have a smile on your face knowing that? I sometimes feel sorry for Holly because it must be tough. She knows a lot more about it than I do. All the ins and outs of what we do to those animals. How do you live with that and not just want to just kill every butcher you see? How do you do it? You know, and you would do it because you practice samatha meditation, tranquility meditation. It's like a spiritual prophylactic. It prevents you from having direct contact with the obscenity of the world. This world where humans are treated as poorly as animals, and where everybody's out for their own, and hardly anybody cares about anybody else or anything else. And can you still walk in the world and smile and laugh and joke? You can. Because the world is just the way the world is. And we give it that value of being good or bad or neutral. And in order to be effective as a human being, we have to be able to transcend. We can't take the burden of this world on our shoulders, or we will just kill ourselves, because there is no solution other than protecting ourselves. So samatha meditation is designed to protect us in all the places in the world we never want to go. Katrina hurricane, we end up there anyway. Volunteering at the food bank, volunteering in a hospital, all the places we wouldn't normally go, and our practice calls us to go there because people are suffering. Tranquility meditation can allow us to be more effective, can allow us to relate to our other humans and dogs and cats and every other creature in a way that's skillful and reduces their suffering. And it's not through sympathy, you know, because we're sort of them and they're sort of us. And so when you look at that little dog who's got 7 days to live, you're looking at yourself. A piece of yourself has 7 days to live if nobody adopts it. Bummer. So what are these magical 40 kinds of meditation? And I have them. There we go. They're all right here, 40 right here. How cool is that? Number one, we have the 10 kasinas. And they are earth, water, fire, air, blue, yellow, red, white, light, and limited space. How cool is that? And what you would do, according to the Visuddhimagga, the path of purification, if you were doing an earth kasana, is you would take your position on your cushion outside where there's dirt, and you would draw a circle in the dirt, and you would concentrate on that circle, and you would say to yourself, earth, 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 over and over and over again. And then you'd close your eyes to see if you could see the circle in your head, and if you couldn't see the circle in your head, you'd open your eyes and go, earth, 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 and ultimately you want to get that circle you've drawn in the earth in your head. You can see it so clearly. In the same way, I took the words off the page to learn that song, and now the words have went from the page to my head, and most of them came out of my lips correctly. But to have the exact word from the page in your head to have the exact image from the earth into your head. Once it's in your head, you would then make it really, really small and really, really big. You would start working with it. And what you would start to see is that the image of the earth was even more spectacular in your head than it was on the earth. And you do that with light and color and limited space. And it's cool. There's Dharmakaya. There's a Buddhist, Thai Buddhist group. They have a temple in Azusa. And they do this kind of meditation. And they have like a crystal ball looking thing. And all the monks are lined up. And in front of them is this crystal ball. And they want to get the ball in their head. And then they take the ball from their head into their belly. And they hold it there. That's where the power of your meditation practice comes from, your belly. And I asked one of the monks, I said, how long did it take you to get that crystal ball from that pedestal into your head, into your belly? And he said, 10 years. Man, that's a long time to look at a crystal ball. But that's the power the mind has. And so it will make you tranquil. It will make you happy. It'll bring you pleasure because you'll have a concentrated mind. Okay, now we go from that to the 10 kinds of foulness. And I know you don't think this is going to lead to much happiness, bliss, or pleasure, but it will lead to a realistic assessment of the world around you. So the 10 kinds of foulness, the bloated, the livid, the festering, the cut up, the gnawed, the scattered, the hacked and scattered, the bleeding, the worm infested, and a skeleton. So in the old days, they would go to the local cemetery, which wasn't much of a cemetery. It was like a charnel ground where the bodies were just sort of thrown so the jackals could eat them. And they'd observe those bodies. And they'd see these different aspects in those bodies. What this tends to do ultimately is it tends to lead you away from the attachment to body, your body and the bodies of others. It gives you a more realistic view of what the human body is. A few years ago, do you remember at the Science Center they had that exhibition with all the bodies with the skin off and stuff? That was so cool, you know? And it's so odd to think of people actually being that without their skin on. But that's, I guess, what we are. So this is sort of designed to just take those clenched fingers filled with lust and desire and craving, and just relax them a little bit. Okay. Then we have the 10 recollections. The recollection of the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, virtue, generosity, the virtues of the deities, death, the body, the breath, and ultimately peace. Peace in this case is nirvana, the ultimate peace. Then we have the 4 divine abodes, and they are metta, karuna, mudita, and upeka, which is loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Cool. You've heard of those, the divine abodes, also known as the 4 immeasurables in Mahayana. Then we have the repulsiveness of nutriment, the repulsiveness of food. We don't need to join Jenny Craig. We just need to involve ourselves in the repulsiveness of food. And why would we want to do that? Because monks only get to eat twice a day. And they're not supposed to like the food they're eating, even if it tastes really good and it was cooked specifically for them. They're supposed to look at their food as medicine. The medicine that keeps them alive so they can practice the Dharma and achieve their full perfection as a human being. And if you get too attached to that food, you're not going to want to achieve nirvana. You're going to want to be a chef, or at least marry one. So you can have as much food as you can have. And then last but not least, reflecting on earth, water, fire, and air, the ancient way of looking how the world is put together, the building blocks of the world, earth, water, fire, and air. So, solidity, liquidity, heat, and ether, as they used to say in the old days. 40 kinds of meditation that will bring you happiness, bliss, and pleasure. Now that you're ready Okay, you've got this spiritual prophylactic on now. Now it's time for mindfulness. Because mindfulness is tough. Mindfulness is looking at things exactly the way they are, but not in a sustained, concentrated way, in a momentary, concentrated way. It's just a quick flash. You look, you see, you understand, you leave. You look, you see, you understand, you leave. So there's four kinds of mindfulness, as you probably already know. Mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of sensations, mindfulness of the mind, and mindfulness of mental objects. Those are the four kinds of mindfulness meditation practices, 40 kinds of samatha meditation practice, 44 different kinds of Buddhist meditation practice we have available to us. In our mindfulness meditation, we want to find the three aspects of Buddhist wisdom. We want to understand them as being true, and we want to understand them as being the vehicle to our liberation. The three aspects of Buddhist wisdom will allow us to achieve nirvana, because it allows us to have a healthy form of detachment. Now, everybody talks about non-attachment. Buddhism is about non-attachment. And I tell you what, it's hard not to be attached. There's a lot of cool things out there. You know, we like our shoes, we like our car, we like our flat screen TV. We're attached. We don't want to let those things go. But the attachment leads to the false impression that we own it, and then we need to control it and protect it and maybe even insure it. And it starts to run our life. My sister has had two storage lockers for 10 years. She hasn't looked in one of them for 10 years. Is she attached? I'm not going to tell her that's the case. She won't listen to this on iTunes. But yeah, how much stuff do you have in storage? And why? So nobody else can touch it or look at it or use it or think they own it. And then finally, one day we open the doors and the light shines on all our precious objects and we go, geez, this record player is 20 years old. I can't even find any vinyl records I want to play on it, because now they're collector's items. I don't want to ruin the grooves. So what will help us let go? Number one, understanding impermanence. Understanding the transitory nature of the world, life, and our life in particular. Understanding that anything we try to hold on to will be taken away from us because of impermanence. Anything we attach to will disappoint us because of impermanence. What we like today will be different tomorrow. We may not like it tomorrow. And I'm of the mind that some relationships don't work because people grow apart. They are surprised when they seem to grow in different directions. But everything changes because of conditions. And so nothing stays the same very long. You might say everything changes moment to moment. Okay. So in our mindfulness meditation practice, what we are doing is we're focusing, number one, for instance, on sensation. Does any sensation last very long? Some last longer than others, but they never last forever. Okay, so we look at the sensations of our body, we look at the sensations of our emotions arising, and we start to analyze them and critique them and come to the conclusion that within this fathom-long body that I reside, everything is in a constant state of flux and change, and then we apply this insight to the world around us. I think that's why they call it insight meditation, maybe. And then we look at the world around us and everything is changing all the time. And there's nothing to hold on to. There's nothing that really we can call ours, not even ourselves. And so our fingers relax just a little bit. Okay, you're not holding and grasping and clinging and wanting as much as you did before, because now you're starting to see impermanence everywhere, all the time. Then we come to the second aspect, it's suffering. Unsatisfactoriness, disappointment with the world and with ourselves. And this is when it's really good to have that samatha meditation practice underneath your belt, because now you're going to be looking at why the world sucks, and you're going to be investigating that, and you're going to be seeing clearly exactly why it does suck, and there's nothing you can do about it except come to a place of profound acceptance of the way things are. That's the only antidote to this suffering. You can't change it. You can't make it better. Sometimes in trying to make it better, you make it worse. So you need to accept the world exactly the way it is, and it's filled with impermanence and disappointment and unsatisfactoriness. And yet, because of your samatha meditation, you're still smiling, you still have a happy demeanor, you see the irony of everything that arises, exists, and passes away, and you're not really, it's not really hard to be around you. Have you been around people that are too serious about everything? Geez, they just drive me nuts. Because everything's important, you know? I didn't get the ketchup with the fries. So, no, this is important. I can't eat it without ketchup. Oh. And you just, you know, so it helps us lighten up. It just helps us lighten up. And then last but not least, the third aspect of insight that comes to us is the fact that nothing is the way it seems. That nothing exists independently. That nothing has a soul or a self or an essence that stands apart from the conditions in the process. And the Catholics are not happy about this when the Buddhists bring it up, because they don't buy it. And the Hindus don't either. But the Buddhists are saying, hey, you know, you might say there's a soul, but is that who you really are? Who are you really? And what it turns out, it seems to me, is that we are really simply a process that's conditional, changing every moment because of the ever-changing conditions every moment. And this is the final place we got to go. Because this is when we finally let go. This is finally when we have healthy non-attachment. Number one, everything is changing. There's nothing to hold on to. Number two, because of all that change, everything will ultimately be unsatisfactory and make you unhappy. And number three, there is no one to hold on to and no one to be unhappy. There's simply a process that occurs because of a billion different conditions manifesting every moment in our life. And when that final piece of the puzzle gets put in there, we have this thing called nirvana. And we're never, ever unhappy again. We never ever suffer again. We come to a place of profound peace because we see the world the way that it really is, and somehow it's okay. But now you say to yourselves, that's a cop-out, because all those people are still suffering. All those animals are still being eaten every day. And now you're just going to kick back and be peaceful. And now you have to go back and see what the Buddha did. What did the Buddha do when he received or realized his nirvana? After he realized his nirvana, he didn't get more than 3 hours of sleep a night. He was out there teaching and encouraging and cheerleading every human who wanted to listen to his talk on how to end their suffering. And why? Why would he want to do that? Isn't the world just the way it's supposed to be? Isn't that what we've done? We've come to that place. We've now seen it. And it is a terrible place to live. And isn't that why we just sort of kick back and find our peace, our internal happiness, our pleasure, our joy? Well, the Buddhist is motivated to go back into the world, go back into the marketplace, because people are suffering. Not because they want to change the world. Not because they can change the world. Not because it's the right thing to do. It's because humans and others are suffering. But you're now helping them with a sense of humor and a peaceful disposition. You're listening to the worst stories you've ever heard, and you go, yeah, it sucks to be human. I know. But the Buddha was the world physician. He gave us a prescription. We can live in this world and not suffer. And he showed us how to do it. And this is the only religion in the world. If you don't want to look at it as a religion, it's the only meditation practice in the world that will allow you to end your suffering. Some religions think that suffering builds character. Buddhism will not go there. If we don't have to suffer, why should we? And as it turns out, we don't have to suffer. So, the making of a monk or a nun is to keep those people in the world full time. Not to get them distracted by family and friends, the new car, the career. Give them some food, a place to live, some nice clothes to wear, and get them out there sharing this prescription to anybody who cares about it, to anybody who's suffering. And if you don't suffer, you don't need Buddhism. But I haven't met anybody yet who's not suffering. So I'm glad we have Buddhism in the world. I'm glad we have monastics that do this full time. And that conference I'm going to hopefully will give me more clarity in what, why, and how. I'm going to end now because I've spoken a lot. And I know we got places to go and things to do. So a quick Buddhist blessing for everyone today, and I will send you on your way. By the power of truth found in the Buddha Dharma, may all misfortunes due to stars, demons, harmful spirits, and ominous planets be prevented and destroyed. May the rain fall in due time. May there be a rich harvest. May the world be prosperous. May the governments be righteous. With the powers of all the fully awakened Buddhas, with the powers of all the fully awakened Bodhisattvas, may those of us sitting here today be secure and protected in every way.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.